listeners, and welcome to the seventh episode of the House of Deputies Blue Book podcast. I'm your host, President of the House of Deputies, Julia Ayala Harris, and it is my pleasure to guide you through the fascinating world of the General Convention and its interim bodies. This podcast is your bridge to staying informed, engaged, and connected with the pulse of the Episcopal Church. Whether you're a deputy to the 81st General Convention, a member of a local parish, or simply a church geek, you have come to the right place for valuable insights, thought-provoking conversations, and a deeper understanding of our church's role in today's rapidly changing world. The General Convention is the governing body of the Episcopal Church, meeting every 3 years. This time we're meeting 2 years later because of the pandemic. It's made up of deputies and bishops from each diocese. And in the months leading up to General Convention, a number of Blue Book reports are created by standing committees, task forces, and what we call interim bodies of the Episcopal Church. Interim because they're bodies between General Conventions. These reports provide background context and review process on various church initiatives and programs. They also put forth policy recommendations for priorities, budgets, and potential resolutions for General Convention to consider. In the past, the reports were published in a book with a blue cover, hence the term Blue Book Reports. Brilliant, isn't it? This book helps deputies and bishops prepare for discussions and decisions at General Convention. However, it's important to note the Blue Book is now completely virtual and is no longer a literal book, but that's for the General Convention office to answer. Some of the key Blue Book reports cover topics like the church's budget, social justice issues, church structure and governance, liturgy and music, ministry programs, ecumenical relations, and more. Blue Book reports shape the agenda and output of each General Convention. They provide critical information that underpins the church's priorities, policies, budget, and administration for the next triennium. Today, we are joined by Deputy Paul Kennedy from the Task Force on the State of Membership in the Episcopal Church and Deputy Charles Graves from the Task Force to Study Household and Relationship Diversity for an exploration of the evolving nature of church membership and how our understanding of family and relationships is expanding within the church community. Deputies Kennedy and Graves share insights into the challenges and opportunities of changing demographics and societal norms, highlighting how these shifts impact membership and the inclusivity of diverse households in the Episcopal Church. Through their conversation, you will gain an understanding of the church's efforts to adapt and grow in ways that reflect the richness of human experience and relationship dynamics. So let's dive right into it. Welcome, Deputies Paul and Charles, to the podcast.
Thank you so much.
It's so good to be here with you two. So let's get started. And let's, one of the things that's really great, I think, about this podcast is that deputies get to learn about other deputies. And so tell us a little bit about who you are, where you live, what your ministries are. Let's start with you, Paul.
I am Paul Kennedy. I'm the rector of Christ Episcopal Church in New Bern, North Carolina. New Bern was the colonial capital of North Carolina, and we were the chapel for the king's governor way back when. So we've been around since about 1715. The town has grown around us. Our claim to fame is that from my office, I can see the pharmacy where Pepsi Cola was made. I say that as I sip a Diet Coke, but all's fair in love and the cola wars. I've been at Christ Church. I'm one of those people who came here as the associate rector and then became the rector after an interim period after the previous rector left. So actually the other day was the ninth anniversary of the announcement that I had been named rector. So been here for a minute.
Congratulations.
Thanks.
Yeah. I must say this podcast is not about cola wars, but I am from a Pepsi family and I had a Pepsi and just finished it shortly before for a little extra zing before this podcast. And Paul, I had thought you and I could be friends.
I'm going to bring you some Pepsi merch.
There's merch over there. Okay.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I'll bring you some this summer.
Such a Pepsi household that my cousin, while watching the eclipse recently, because this will be, you know, we're recording much sooner than everyone will hear this.
Yeah.
Watch the eclipse in front of the Pepsi Cola sign in New York.
That's awesome.
Because he wanted to be that close to Pepsi. It's a whole thing.
Okay. Okay.
Thanks, Paul. And congratulations on 9 years.
Thanks.
Charles, tell us a little bit about your ministries, where you are.
Sure. It wasn't your icebreaker, but I'll start out with my drink of choice, my beverage of choice. This podcast is not sponsored by our various beverages, but I happen to be drinking a ginger ale.
You have Canada Dry ginger ale.
I forget what, I actually don't remember which company owns it, so somebody will pipe up.
It's the Canada Dry Verners. Michiganders are big on Verner's ginger ale, and they're very different. Yeah, so that's a whole. We'll have a podcast on sodas in the future.
I am, as I said, Charles Graves. Pronouns are he and him. I have been for 5 years now the campus minister or campus missioner, as we say in Texas, for Houston Canterbury, which is the Episcopal campus ministry. Serving primarily three universities, University of Houston, University of Houston Downtown, and Texas Southern University. And I get to be a first-time deputy at this convention, so I'm very excited. I have also, since 2019, been a member of Executive Council. I happen to be in Baltimore right now, but I was born and raised in Baltimore. I like to say that my very first rector was one Michael Curry before everybody knew how cool he is. I'm very proud of that. And it's a delight to be with you. Thanks for having me again.
Thanks, Charles. So our next question is the icebreaker question. I'll call on Charles first to give Paul a little bit of time because maybe you have to think about, I don't know. But I thought this one would suit you both. If you had to delete all but three apps from your smartphones, which ones would you keep? Okay, Paul looks like he's making notes. Are you really writing down your answer? Charles just had the most hilarious. I wish in some ways this was a video podcast in these moments.
You could see me lean back and sigh. My first inclination is to be like super boring and say the stuff that I would keep would be like, I don't know, like, you know, my email app, my like calendar app, like that kind of stuff. Not very fun, but like the fun thing, I don't know, the more fun kind of stuff. Of course, being a college missioner, I spend a lot of time on Instagram and TikTok. I'm gonna say that it's because I'm a college minister and not because, you know, I just spend a lot of time scrolling videos on Instagram, you know, Facebook and TikTok. So those would be my backup three.
Okay. All social media apps as you sip your ginger ale. How about you, Paul?
Okay.
You're still writing notes.
No. Hands are here. I would have to keep a notes app of some kind, probably just the native one on my phone. The notes app, I would keep Instagram. I maybe have a little addiction to Instagram, but that's okay. Notes and Instagram and probably email. I mean, I hate email on my phone, but it's handy.
What if we took off things like email, calendar? It's just
I didn't even think about calendar. I use my phone for my calendar all the time. So
yeah,
maybe that's the only way I know where I'm going. So calendar, Instagram, and a notes app. Those would be my answers.
But what if it's not like just the fact that our phones are our brains?
Yeah.
Then what would you keep? Like, does someone have an old addiction to like, what were like,
well, I have a game that I have like a Tetris kind of game. It's not Tetris itself, but that I go back and forth. Like I'll delete it cause I'll just realize I'm playing it too much and then I'll delete it and then put it back on later. So yeah, that would be one. I would keep like a Brick Breaker game of some kind.
Oh, interesting. What about you, Charles? Angry Birds?
No, not
Subway Surfer
of like a phone game. My husband does all the time. I don't even know the name of it, but it's like he definitely does some game where he's like crushing jewels or something. I don't know. It sounds really stupid, but Candy Crush. One of those kind of things.
I actually should have asked if we're allowed to say any of the names of these things, or if we're going to get in trouble with our copyright. So I hope that's all right, as I'm naming like pops and apps and all right, yeah, I'm going to save myself and move along. Stick to the blue book, Julia.
All right. You're going to have to cut out the first 5 minutes.
And they're like, oh, this podcast sounds different. All right, let's start with you, Paul. Tell us about the interim body that you served on and what initiatives are going to be coming to General Convention. We're getting down to brass tacks now.
All right. Yeah. So I had the honor of serving as the chair for the task force on the state of membership in the Episcopal Church. And we had a pretty broad directive. Our mandate came out of the previous iteration of the State of the Church Committee, which I also served on. And so was glad to be able to do some work to carry this on. Our primary work was around what are the definitions of membership in the Episcopal Church, and what does it mean? What do all these different, you know, categories mean? And if we look in Canon 1.17, which I did not have memorized, I had to look at my notes. Nice.
That's very impressive.
Then we have a lot of levels of membership. It almost doubles when you consider we have membership levels for people under the age of 16, and then membership for people over the age of 16. And so we were just trying to, you know, wrap our minds around that and sort of what are the differences between what people can do in the church as a just a baptized member versus a confirmed communicant in good standing, and what do all those things, what do all those things mean and do? And so we realized that the, you know, 15 or so of us from across the country, it was a really great representative group, that we had, we all had opinions, right? I mean, we all had stuff, but we realized our opinions, our perspectives were all going to be really different than maybe what the experience was of the wider church. So we worked amongst ourselves, got some input from some other people about putting together a church-wide survey, which we did. Some of it was just data questions, and others of it was, you know, open-ended, tell us what you think. And people did, rest assured. And we went through bishop offices because we didn't want to just put it out. Like, we didn't want it to be in the Episcopal News Service or just the House of Deputies newsletter, because that was a pretty targeted audience. And we sent it to bishops' offices or in, you know, whatever ecclesiastical authority offices, and said, name five churches, name 5 to 6 churches that represent the broadest spectrum you can get in your diocese. Rural, urban, suburban, small, large, all of that. And the, you know, the nice part is we got pretty good response. We were told it was a good response. The General Convention Office said that getting responses from 37 dioceses and then getting a response from 81 parishes.
Holy cow.
Was good. Yeah. Right. So, yeah. I mean, we were all sort of like, that's all. Right? We have 100 and something dioceses and all we got was 37. But we were told that was really good. So we went with it. Unfortunately, there was no one from outside the United States who responded. So none of the churches in Europe or Asia or South and Central America responded. But we got a really wide range of stuff, right? And really wide range of, because we asked questions about transferring membership, you know, what's it, what's your experience with that? And do you bother with it? I mean, we have these triplicate forms that are really, you know, fun to fill out and on run through a typewriter if you still have one of those. But, you know, one of the responses was, wouldn't it be cool to be able to do it online? I mean, the church uses Substack all the time. So why couldn't there be a way to transfer membership or request membership from one church to another and not have all this paperwork
in 2024?
Imagine, right? So I think that was, you know, that was really the, that was a lot of the crux of our work. I mean, our Blue Book report ended up being about 80 pages long, but 70 of that was the survey, right?
Okay.
Because we didn't edit out. We did not. This was the raw data of all of this, all the people who responded to the survey. And some people had one line answers and some people had one book answers. So, so that was the crux of our work. And we are, I can talk about it a little bit later, but we are proposing a, you know, a canon change to reflect sort of what the reality is of membership. And that is to remove the idea of a communicant, right? So you're a communicant, either you're a baptized member or you're a communicant in good standing, right? That's the next level. And then confirmed communicant, because a communicant in good standing is someone who has received communion three times in the previous year. Mm-hmm. But according to some historians who we talked to in the church as well, that was as much about making sure the priests were doing their job and showing up to the churches as it was about making sure the people were showing up to church. And so recognizing that there are places for which it's hard to get a priest, even a couple of times a year. And yet the rest of the canon talks about people being present, right? Being present in the life and contributing to the life of the church. That's what's most important. And so, that was the crux of our work. And, you know, I'm sorry if people are going to print out our report. It's going to take a lot of paper, read it on a computer screen or your iPad or something like that. But that was the crux of our work, and we had a good time doing it. And, we had some really good conversations around it.
That is so interesting. Oh my gosh. Charles, tell us about the task force you were on and what initiatives are coming to General Convention. Then after, I'm already excited about questions later on in this podcast, but go ahead, Charles. I'm already jazzed.
Good. I'll try and be brief then. So our task force on household and relationship diversity, I actually had the pleasure to write the resolution last time that created it, although I wasn't a deputy last time, and so thanks to the Reverend and deputy again, RJ Powell, for sponsoring that one. And that one allows us basically to, in our task force, to study all the various, or as many as we can, with various areas in our church that where we may not be doing as good a job as we hope at supporting all different kinds of families and households in our respective churches, our congregations, so on. You know, I think we have very noble ambitions oftentimes, and you know, we say all the time, you know, that we're a church for everyone and all are welcome, and you know, this is who we are. And you know, yet I meet, you know, families all the time for which, you know, if they don't kind of look like the quote unquote norm, or one of maybe several norms, then you know, it's just harder sometimes for parishes to kind of quote unquote know what to do with them, if you will. So, for example, you know, a couple walks in, you know, they're young, they're about my age, they may be in their 30s, you know, they've got a young baby or two or three kids, and like everybody climbs all over them, you know, just trying to grab hold of them, right? And yet a single adult walks in, you know, whether, you know, or a single parent or something. And, you know, it's just a kind of natural phenomenon, or a phenomenon that we see all the time. You know, church members kind of just don't know what to do, or, you know, don't know what to say. And it makes it difficult for those folks to kind of be able to find a place in the church, right? You know, you know, everywhere from, you know, many churches kind of Mother's Day traditions, you know, to give like a rose or something to, you know, everyone that they identify as a woman in the church. But of course, you know, if you're non-binary, or if you are trans, or if you, you know, have complications and or kind of a complicated relationship with a day like Mother's Day, you know, that actually makes it a lot harder for you in relating to the church. And there are all sorts of situations like that that we're kind of learning about. And there are various ways in which the canons in our church, are particularly diocesan canons, around, you know, things like marriage, have kind of some implications, or at least might not fit as well the world and the church we live in today.
We lost Charles briefly. You're back.
I got a spam. All right, I'm back.
Okay.
I got a spam call and it cut me off. Sorry.
It's funny you got muted right when you're about to.
I know. No, I think I hope I finished that sentence. But yeah, the ways that the canons, there are ways that some of the canons in our diocese just might not fit the ways in which we live, the ways in which we live. And there are lots of situations that I think are not anticipated by that. So for example, you know, someone who's part of a couple may not be able to participate fully in the discernment process. If, you know, if they're part of a couple that are not married, and there may be, you know, so we're looking at things like the kind of rules around cohabitation, you know, that don't anticipate things like, you know, maybe one or both members of the couple might be immigrants, you know, and they might have complicated visa statuses or disability statuses or things like that, or financial statuses that just make that not possible or not feasible. And I think a lot of that is kind of unanticipated, but those are very real justice issues that exist in our church. And so we're looking at kind of all those sorts of issues and how we can do a better job of supporting all different kinds of families and households and kind of relationship structures in our church.
Thank you, Charles. One of the things that I really like about this podcast is when I decide who's going to be with whom on the podcast, I really like, I call it like a bag of Skittles. Like sometimes you just want to toss in different flavors and see what happens when green and yellow are in your mouth at the same time. And so for this podcast, and so I pick from different areas of the church, which is why for the most part, at every podcast, the deputies who are in that podcast together are meeting each other for the first time because they're not even adjacent ministries, right? And there's so many silos in the church. And with these two topics, with your two task forces, the state of membership and the study of household and relationship diversity, there's like nothing that overlaps, except there totally is. And one of the areas that I know both of you have talked about for as an example is, okay, so you have one in a partnership, one person who's Episcopalian, and let's say one is the other is Jewish or Muslim or Presbyterian, you know, and what do you do with that? And in membership, it's, well, what if that person comes to the Episcopal Church? What if they are tithing through the family? How do you handle that kind of membership? And with you, Charles, that even comes up with discernment, like we're saying, because a lot Absolutely. Of people are going to say, if you're married to someone who's not Episcopalian, how could you be ordained in the Episcopal Church? Right. And so it's really interesting, which leads me to the question of, that's one of the ways I see that what both of your task forces mm-hmm. are doing as challenging us to live into our baptismal covenant this summer. But can you tell us more? And I'll go to you, Paul. About how the initiatives that you all are bringing to General Convention will challenge us to live into our baptismal covenant.
I was grateful for that question. I think that what our group is really looking at is that very first question about, will you continue in the apostles' teaching and fellowship and the breaking of the bread and then the prayers? Because what we're looking at really is, is who's a part of, who's a part of us, you know? I mean, it's one of the things I've appreciated in the work we did in the previous State of the Church, and that the parochial committee report in the current State of the Church committee has looked at is looking at who's a part of us, right? And so we may have members, we may have people who are never going to be an official member. They're not going to get baptized or confirmed, but my God, they are here every Sunday, right? Mm-hmm. I can think of several people who sing in our choir, you know, who this is where they are fed. This is where they give back, all that good stuff. But they're not, when we're like, oh, you're not officially a member. They're like, nope, sure not. Maybe one day, but they're not now. But we don't want to say like, well, I guess you can't sing in the choir because you're not officially a member. So I think that's part of how, when we're looking at what are the ways that people are continuing in the apostles' teaching and that very first question in the baptismal covenant? And how are we, how is the church then equipping those people, whether or not they're members, but how do we count them? And I think what Charles was talking about, what you were talking about, like, we, you know, every church probably has people who are a split family, right? I mean, we have another person who is a diehard member, but his wife goes to another church and she's a diehard member, and that's great. But they're both listed on our directory, right? So she's not a member, but she's in our directory.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I myself, I've sometimes been a member, or been maybe a member of one church, but listed in the directory at two or three different churches at a time. Because, you know, I grew up in one church, but went to college and went to the church near there. And then, you know, went to seminary and went to the church near there. And, you know, they kept wanting to have me on, you know, at all three. So it's like, it creates all these complications. I'm really glad that y'all are working on that.
And then you check your bank statements and you're still tithing to all three churches. And it's like, oh, yeah. All right.
Well, I do that purposefully, but yeah. Absolutely. No, it's a real thing. I mean, you were talking, Julie, about mixed faith, you know, couples and families. I am part of one. My husband, you know, might get after me for mentioning him on this podcast, but my husband is non-religious for the most part, and is not a church goer anywhere. And you know, folks, you know, kind of ask me as a priest, like, kind of look at me kind of askance or upside down and say, so how does that work? You know, say, well, he waits for me at home when I get back and so on. But yeah, there's a lot of those kind of unanticipated, you know, situations, right? It was kind of assumed for the longest time that, you know, if you're right, if, you know, one person went to church, their spouse presumably would also go and sit with them, right? It's not the case so much anymore. Or for those of us that are clergy, you know, that our respective clergy spouses would, you know, sit in the front row and, you know, do all the things that were once kind of assumed. And of course, we just don't live in that world anymore. So I'm excited. I'm glad that kind of both of our bodies, of our interim bodies, are kind of working on helping our church to live into our baptismal covenant now, you know, and not now and for the future, and kind of hopefully help to dispense with some of the assumptions and the ways that we've kind of built tradition, if you will, on top of a lot of assumptions that may not work anymore.
Well, Charles, when I was hearing you, and I don't know which one of the ones this would fit under in the baptismal covenant, but I hear your group talking about is, how do you support people, right? How do you support households and families, which is, to me, you know, recognition that the church continues to, the church is made up of every kind of family there is. And, and how do we support that? Right. Cause we shouldn't be in this, we shouldn't be in the business of saying, no, you have to fit in this little mold right here. But like, how do we keep loving you? How do we love on you and help you grow, into the people God made you to be?
Absolutely. I mean, it really is. I know it's like probably the most cited part of the baptismal covenant, but for us it really is about respecting the dignity of every human being, you know. If you're the single person that walks into church and, you know, finds this community interesting and, you know, you want to know more about it, but then, you know, you see on the other side of the church and frankly for the most part, you know, cisgender heterosexual couple that walks in on the other side of the church with their, you know, two young bouncing kids and everybody jumps all over them, you know, then, you know, I mean, that hurts, right? You're like, well, you know, what's wrong with me? And so we want to figure out how, you know, how we can help provide resources and maybe help walk alongside churches and communities and dioceses who really do, you know, want to know that, you know, that single person or that person, you know, from a single parent household or that couple that may be different, you know, than kind of what you might expect. And, you know, just kind of not even realize that they're, you know, treating anybody differently.
Being from a family myself that was really conspicuous, I guess you could say, and unique in the 80s at the time, and then later being a teenager who went to church alone without a family, I really appreciate these discussions because it was always so hard. And it's an interesting thing because every parish when they're looking for a new rector, always wants young families, mm-hmm. right? They always want to grow the church, you know, all these things. And so we're even in our biographies or profiles, sorry, our parish profiles, mm-hmm. we are embedding certain cultural norms and mores and expectations of who we want to have feel comfortable in our pews.
Yeah.
And that's where I really appreciate both of your all task forces.
Yeah. Well, and when we say young families, what exactly do we mean?
Right. Amen.
Amen. Exactly. What do we mean? You know?
And look, I can tell you, as someone who was named rector, who had a young family at the time, right? I mean, my son was 6 and my daughter was 2. You know, sometimes they didn't know what to do with that.
You know? Yeah. We are not good at knowing what to do with young families.
Right. We're not. We're not.
You know, if your kids run around and want to go hang out with their dad on the altar, folks are like, oh my God, how could they ever?
Look, I tell people all the time, people thought it was super cute. My son would, when he was, even before he was that, he would say, he would want to walk out with me. And everyone just thought, oh, it was so cute. And then I had to say, it's because when we get to the back, he says, can I go to the playground? Right. It wasn't, he wanted the early exit to get to the playground first.
Almost a Judas walk, actually.
Yeah. I got this.
Right. And it happens sometimes in clergy search. I mean, when I was the last time I was in a clergy search 5 years ago, I was very much single. I was a single man at 29 years old. And, you know, congregations kind of, again, didn't know what to do with that you may not get treated as the same level of kind of real adult if you're not mm-hmm. married, if you don't have children. You may be the
sure.
not that it, you know, age is that, you know, kind of a factor, but you may be the same age and have, you know, just as sophisticated as anybody else, but you know, if you're not married and you don't have a couple of kids, it's like, oh well, I don't know if we can sort of have that person. When you're again, you can be the person it comes from a sort of kind of again, quote unquote traditional looking couple, if you will, and folks are like, oh great, we'll invite, sorry, I don't mean to kind of I'm not going after you, Paul, but you're the new rector that comes in with 2 or 3, young kids and, spouse. And they're like, oh, well, your spouse can, teach Sunday school and your kids can be acolytes.
Do all the hospitality.
Like, yeah, right, right. It's like, no, you're hiring a rector. You're not hiring a rector's family, right?
Amen.
They don't come with a deal. Yeah.
And at the same time, if we ever get time to do more podcasting in the future that's not solely related to Blue Book, but church, issues facing the church, is how many churches actually can't afford to hire mm-hmm. clergy because they have a family, because of our health insurance, which goes back to our podcast episode number 1 with Deputy David Sibley, versus mm-hmm. a single person. So it's like we're even having this bizarre sort of friction with what our churches can afford versus, it's so overlapping and strange, the areas that we find ourselves in as church. And yet really good, because these are holy questions that we need to be asking ourselves and mm-hmm. wrestling with mm-hmm. For inclusivity.
Yeah.
Were you going to say something, Paul? Did I?
I was going to say, some of this goes back to even to Charles, the ministry you're engaged in campus ministry was like, mm-hmm. those folks aren't even counted. Right.
Yeah,
I mean, like,
I meant to mention that and I forgot. Yes.
No, and that's in our report. It's like we got to figure out how to count these people, right? Because we're on one level, we're probably overcounting on some stuff, but also we're undercounting in some other areas, areas that actually have real ministry. You know, I mean, like campus ministry is huge.
Yeah, and it's funny, every church, every parish I go to, they're all like, "Where are the young people? Where are the young people?" And I'm like, a lot of them are in campus ministry, mm-hmm. and yet we don't count them, which skews our numbers. And then more and more, we're like, "Where are young people?" Now, hear me well. I'm not itching to do a parochial report.
Yes, you are. Everyone is.
We're Charles. Making them shorter. And they were. We have a whole podcast on that about how much better the parochial report will be going forward.
All right. Well, maybe next time. But it's, we don't count our campus ministry students unless they join a parish, right? Mm-hmm. So it kind of generates and reinforces a lot of assumptions about the ministry that parishes do versus the ministry that campus ministries and other, affiliated ministries do, right?
And literally, who counts?
And
literally,
who
counts?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Literally.
Mm-hmm. College kids, they don't count.
Right.
We don't count
Right.
them. Yeah.
Unless they join a church, right?
Right.
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 Yeah. Unless he
A
joined
traditional
like a quote
parish.
unquote a real church, a traditional parish.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a whole other, man, I could go on a whole other thing about, you know, how Francis ministries, you know, we don't get the
I'm
respect
like,
we deserve anyway.
I gotta do a whole nother podcast where I'll just sit around drinking tea, talking about musing about all these things. So what are you, as we're looking towards General Convention this summer in person, we already have legislative committees meeting now, doing hearings, but between what we're experiencing now, the online version to the in-person version, what are you most excited about with General Convention? Paul, I'll call on you first.
Okay. I'm looking forward to the exhibit hall. The first general convention in Austin was just, that was my first one. And that was just a lot of fun. You never knew who you were going to run into, in there. And I also remember like in Baltimore, it's like, well, we're not going to have the convention hall. And I'm like, oh, that kind of stinks. And then I think one day I think it started to rain and I had been outside and I came in an entrance to the convention center and I saw the space where it would have been. And it was just like so empty. I was like, oh, this sucks. You know? So I was like, so I was thinking about that question and I was like, yeah, I'll say something different than I think what other people have said. I don't know if anybody else, can't remember if anybody else has said that, but like, I'm looking forward to the convention hall. I think that's going to be a lot of fun.
The Comic-Con.
I mean, the exhibits. Yeah. The
yes.
exhibit hall. That's
yeah.
going to be my favorite.
Yeah.
How about you, Charles?
I love the big family reunion aspect of it.
Yeah.
You know, just like seeing people everywhere from everywhere. I feel like I've been to a ton of various Episcopal conferences and events, and it's always like that, right? Half new friends, half, you know, old friends, or, you know, people I haven't seen in a long time, and that's just really exciting. This will be my fifth general convention to attend, but my first as a deputy. So I'm excited to be on the floor for the first time and kind of experience it from that perspective. I didn't mention the two resolutions from our task force. But
I thought
I
about
really
asking and then I was like, are we running out of time? Let's go for it.
No, I got excited talking about, you know, membership stuff and all that. So, but no, we have A144 and A145, which are kind of companion resolutions to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And the first A144 is just giving us kind of a specific mandate to giving our task force a specific mandate to study our two non-discrimination canons in the church, one of which refers to that we won't discriminate on, of course, a number of factors, one of which is relationship status, and then another one is where it says we won't discriminate based on quote family status.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're looking at, as I mentioned, there are some canons, you know, where some things like diocesan canons and, you know, situations that people get in, for example, in the discernment or ordination process that kind of make us want to study and see if we're actually observing those canons in the way that we should be and the way that we've stated as a church that we will. And a second part of that is that sometimes that means that we're hoping to kind of put out a little bit of a similar study to what you were saying, Paul, and reach out to people in, you know, in pews and in congregations all across our church, you know, who have had situations like kind of what we've described a little bit earlier. And some of that, especially as it relates to things like discernment and ordination processes, mean that we have to kind of create a special level of safety, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these are things that mm-hmm. people, you know, need to be able to be, you know, vulnerable and be truthful and be honest with us, you know, in an anonymous and confidential way, that, you know, where they can kind of come out, if you will, if I can kind of use that language, and tell us who they are, you know, and tell us about, you know, their families and what their family structures look like, and how that has, you know, how that may have created some challenges in their walk in life in every level of our church. So A145 kind of follows from that first resolution, calling us to study these canons. And A145 asks that various kind of disciplinary bodies in our church basically give our task force a little bit of space, if they don't mind, kind of, and help us to give us the space to you know, study folks and ask folks to share their stories with us without that fear of being facing repercussions because they were honest with us in our study. And so that'll help us to be able to move forward toward the 82nd convention. So we're looking forward to that. And we're putting out that study, and we're working with a number of theologians also, kind of like Paul, you were talking about working with historians and things. We're working with some serious and well-known theologians in our church to help us kind of have that broader conversation about family structures, about, frankly, sexuality and sexual ethics and family compositions, you know, in a way that we haven't had in our church other than kind of all the very hearty conversations, if you will, around same-sex marriage. But other than about LGBTQ folk, we really haven't had this conversation in a long, long time. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to work with some folks who can help us and help our congregations to talk about those things and have open conversations in a way that we really haven't.
Yeah. Thank you, Charles. Thank you for calling us back to resolutions, because I was letting the business side of my brain get the, like, oh no, what if we lose them? We'll just keep going. But Paul, did you want to tell us about, okay. Your task force has a resolution. Is that right?
We do. Yeah. So, okay. Thank you. And while Charles was talking, I was like, oh, I don't even know the number of ours. So I was able to look that up because I wanted to look up Charles's as well. So ours is A108, and we're proposing a change to Title I, Canon 17, which is to take out the term of a communicant, since it's this sort of vagary area, and just move from you're either a member, and the next level would be a communicant in good standing, who is contributing to the life of the church in various ways. And we're not proposing changing any of those definitions or requirements about continuing to commit to the prayer and the resources and things like that, right? I mean, we're not changing any of that kind of stuff, not changing anything about baptism. I mean, we really uphold that baptism is the entry point of membership in the church. And then just cleaning up some of the language as well throughout that throughout that canon, it says, talks about transfer as a certificate when we call it a letter of transfer. So just cleaning up some of that language in there as well. And then we're also putting in something, and I'll be interested to hear what the any conversation in committee 2 on constitution and canons around what we would call like an associate member of a church, which is kind of like being a baptized member, but also not. It's something the Presbyterians have. We talked with several Presbyterians around the country about sort of how they use that level of membership. And it's almost like it's sort of what we talked about with people whose family member might be a member somewhere else, but they do participate in the life of the church. Or we have snowbirds, right? I mean, we have some parishioners who spend part of the summer, the warmer months in Upper Michigan, and they're very active in their church there, but they're not members. They could be an associate member and still do things because they're confirmed communicants in good standing here at Christ Church New Bern. Mm-hmm. So I'm looking forward to hearing what else people have to say about that particular resolution in either on the floor. I guess we have to talk about on the floor, right? I can't be on the consent calendar, I don't think.
That's where I'm like,
we'll see what happens.
Yeah. We'll see what happens. I don't know.
We'll see what happens.
Okay, great.
But I like the idea. It's really, really good.
Yeah.
The thing that I'm so excited about is that in some ways, membership, I think for so many people, is binary. You are or you're not.
Right.
And then, like we said, it turns out that a lot of that is cultural context and, you know, our own perceived ideas on whether or not someone can or should be a member. And we're breaking that open. And Charles, as Deputy Graves' task force, is doing the same thing about how we perceive people and families and identity. And oh my gosh, it's going to be so exciting that we're coming into this sort of new era as church, you mm-hmm. know, that we're kind of that, like Canon Stephanie Speller says, that church cracked open, right? Mm-hmm. That we're questioning all kinds of things right now. So as we conclude this discussion, I want to sincerely thank Deputies Kennedy and Graves for their enlightening contributions. Their valuable perspectives have illuminated the vital work of these task forces. To our listeners, thank you for joining us as we explored how the Episcopal Church addresses the statistical and strategic aspects of church membership and delves into the theological and pastoral considerations of embracing household and relationship diversity. Your engagement and curiosity drive this podcast. We are eager to hear your thoughts and questions. Please feel free to contact us through our website or social media channels. Tune in to our next episode on May 8th, when we have our first Outside the Blue Book bonus episode. You will not want to miss it. Until then, keep reflecting, keep the faith at the center of your 81st General Convention journey. Thank you for listening to the House of Deputies Blue Book podcast. Go in peace.